This is the John Clayton Show.
Brought to you by Coors Light, the world's most refreshing beer.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's get you up to date with some headlines. Well, the Seahawks made a move yesterday. Stephen Morris, who they picked up off of waivers from Washington, was waived. He's a quarterback. And the reason they did that, well, they certainly like Alex Magoo. Magoo, of course, a seventh-round pick from Florida International, wowed everybody and surprised everybody at last week's minicamp. And now some people think he could end up being the backup quarterback of this team. Of course, he looked very good. One guy that's not going to be here is Cason Williams. Cason Williams, cut by the Cleveland Browns earlier this week, ended up signing with the Indianapolis Colts. Dwayne Casey, fired. 59 wins for Toronto. The only coach in Raptors history that has been able to get this team to 50 wins, and he's done it three times, and they've gotten better every year, but because he keeps losing to the Cleveland Cavaliers, what ends up happening now, he is a casualty. That's coming the day after he was unanimously voted in by the NBA coaches as the coach of the year. So Dwayne Casey let go. Mariners, of course, have a doubleheader today. Last night, the game was rained out. Just they waited as long as they could, but they couldn't do it. So two games today starts at 1:10. The pregame, of course, right after the show at 12. Marco Gonzalez on the mound for the Mariners in game one, and they definitely need to try to get this victory. But, of course, it's a Detroit team that's in a rebuilding mode and one that is just trying to, you know, salvage something, but it's going to be a tough year for them. Mariners, of course, off to a pretty good start, and those are our headlines. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Joining us right now is Dave Grosby. And, Dave, how are you on this glorious sunny Saturday?
Doing terrific, Johnny boy. How are you?
Doing well. Had a good birthday. That was good. Very nice.
What'd you do?
Ended up going to Daniel's, and I probably ended up having one of my best birthdays since Pat held my 40th birthday party many, many years ago. And so it was great. Brock Hewitt was nice enough to get some treats to the table. I mean, he treated some wine, and he treated some appetizers, and it was just fantastic.
Excellent. Glad to hear it, buddy.
And, of course, I mean, the big one yesterday was the fact that Pat tried to go on the walker and was able to stand for a couple minutes. And now the next phase is to try to get a couple steps and get strong enough to do that.
Well, there's a real birthday present for you right there.
Yeah, so that it worked out pretty well. So a very, very good one. I thank Brock. I thank my wife, and thank everybody who's wished everything. And now it's a matter of getting back to work. And 23 teams are at the rookie mini camps right now, and lots of signings going on, lots of things. And I tell you, this off season just really is moving fast.
Why do you say that?
Because it is. It just, I mean, we're already, well, what amazes me is how the speed of signings. They get faster every year, and there's no reason why they shouldn't, because, you know, what you have is that, everything is slotted very much like the NBA, but we're already about 145 signings that have happened, and things are getting done, which I like.
Good to hear, I guess.
What's that?
I guess I don't really have much of an opinion on that. I'll just take your word for it.
Okay, but I like it because, again, it gets in my database. I still remember back in the old days, still with the database, I would have to go out on training camp trips, and I would have to take all these, all this information, trying to, get the signings and get all those into the database. And and now, I mean, last year there was only like 16 or 17 players that didn't have their deals done by the end of the mini camps, which of course are in June. The way it's going this year, they may have everything done before the start of training camp. The only ones that usually linger are third rounders.
Is there a reason why things have sped up like that in your mind? Is it got to do with collective bargaining or anything like that?
No, well, I guess you can say it's collective bargaining, but I think what it comes down to is there's now a general acceptance that there's not much that goes into the negotiation. The negotiation was done in the last CBA. I mean, you get your slot, you get your signing bonus, you work on the way it's going to get structured, and that's about it. And I think the one thing that I know has happening, the drafts are getting younger. I mean, you had 106 players that were underclassmen. 70 of them got drafted. And then you start to look at the ages of 20 to 22 years old. I know the average age of the draft choices this year are younger. All right, so now you're a younger guy, and you have a choice. You can have your agent go battle for a few extra dollars or get that check right now and start to use it. And that's what players are doing. They're getting their checks right now and starting to use it.
Makes sense. And, boy, the more and more you see guys at training camp, you know, well, you see young guys playing. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no longer let the rookies get acclimated and whatnot. It's funny, even though you don't pay rookies as much as you used to in the NFL, it seems to be like they're playing sooner than they used to.
Oh, yeah, they are. But also what's happening now is that they're getting traded sooner or cut sooner. I mean, you're now two and a half years into a guy that you've drafted, and even if it's a high draft choice, you trade him. I mean, what, eight first-round picks from 2015 have already been traded. Eight. Think about that. You figure, okay, you draft an offensive lineman, you're going to keep him the 4 years, and if you kind of hedge your bets on him, then you give him the fifth-year option and don't give him a contract. Now, it's like, hey, Marcus Peters has given us troubles in Kansas City, we're trading him. Didn't get as much out of Danny Shelton at Cleveland, we're trading him. And you look at the bottom of that first round in 2015, like six guys at the bottom were all traded.
People are less patient these days in all walks of life, aren't they?
I would think so. Now, of course, on the Mariners side, a doubleheader. And this kind of goes back into the old days. Of course, it's rare now that you get a doubleheader.
Yeah, a real doubleheader.
Well, because remember how it used to be with doubleheaders? They used to schedule them.
Used to have them on Memorial Day for sure, Mother's Day occasionally. It was a nice leisurely seven-hour day at the ballpark. And they have gone by the way of the dodo. I mean, there's very few people who would even consider spending that much time at a ballpark. And this is the traditional one today where they're going to play the second game 30 minutes after the first game as opposed to the day-night variety, which is normally what they do if they've got to do it. But I know weather is still a factor in Detroit, so this is important to get these games in for the Mariners, or it's going to wreck their next East Road trip when, like this one is, for example. They're supposed to have an off day to travel. And they're not having it. They got to go make up a game in Minnesota. Now, if this doesn't get in today or tomorrow, this could be a couple of games they got to make up at some point during the season. And they got to make it up when they come back to play in New York or Boston or whatever. So it's important they get them in. But yeah, doubleheaders. I used to love them as a kid. Felt like two for the price of one, and loved the day of the ballpark. But in today's society, I just don't think anyone's ready to commit 7 hours to much of anything anymore. Do you?
No, I agree. I mean, and also from the team standpoint, they like to separate the two because they can get money for them as opposed to, you know, you didn't get your game last night. Now you get your extra ticket and come back for tonight's game or today's game. And so, you know, you don't get that extra revenue or the walk up and all those things.
Right. That's why they went away in the first place was money for the most part, even though, ironically, very little of a baseball team's revenue is attendance anymore. Very, very little. You know, most teams have deals like the Mariners do. Not all, but I should say many teams have deals like the Mariners do, where they basically have their own cable network that is paying them hundreds of millions of dollars, which dwarfs anything they can do with the in terms of tickets. And I don't know if that's why attendance is down. We had an interesting conversation yesterday with Keith Hernandez on the show. He's writing another book and a book about his career a little bit. And just, you know, kind of asked him, you know, I noted in his career, which spanned about 17 years, he struck out 100 times once in his career. And this year you might have two dozen guys who strike out 200 times. And, you know, he just used the line that you know, and I said, you know, baseball sure has changed. And he said, yeah, it's gotten boring. And I do think, you know, analytics and things like that, which have made it clear how to play, you know, I'm not against them or anything like that, but I don't know that it's improved the product of baseball. I don't think the swing for the fences sort of mentality with guys striking out is as entertaining as it used to be. But it's about product these days. Baseball still provides the most product. So, you know, I don't know that A, you got a game that's not necessarily as entertaining, and B, it's not as important people go to the ballpark in terms of making revenue. So it's led to a lot of games. And look, I mean, there's nothing you can do about the weather in Detroit. I mean, it's a bad day today as well. There are not going to be many people there, but you look around at a lot of games in the league and you see real attendance issues, unless you've got a ballpark like Safeco, which is such a great place to go anyway, and you've got people going there, especially in that center field area, just to have a good time, which is a rarity. I mean, unless you got something like that, it's tough to draw fans these days.
Yeah, it really is. And, of course, and that's the key. And I know football still worries about getting fans in because, you know, making sure they have the fan experience. But, you know, there's now so many more options for people that want to follow football that don't have to go to the games and don't have to spend that money. Because, again, it can be very expensive right. if you haven't got a family.
Well, it sure is. I mean, that's obviously true in all sports. And football has always been concerned about that optics sometimes to distraction when they used to have the blackout rule and actually didn't show games on TV. That went by the boards mainly because of the same sort of scenario that I told you about baseball, that football's making so much money in other aspects. But, it's optics. It's optics. You want to have, there's just the simple fact of looking and having games on TV without a lot of people there, you know, can make people suddenly wonder, well, geez, no one cares. Why do I care? It's a mentality that has permeated in some sports. But again, with revenue the way it is right now, it's not that important to have live gates, which is why I think in the future, and I noticed that there's a stadium issue going on now in Phoenix and whatnot, even though population is growing, I think you'll see ultimately in the next 20, 30 years, smaller stadiums built for all the sports. Because so much of the games are available, and as you pointed out already, in so many different ways that they'll make it a premium experience to go to the game, and have fewer seats and smaller footprint to build things, less money to build things, et cetera, et cetera. I think that could be in the future for professional sports.
Yeah, it's funny. I know that there's been this talk. It's like after seeing the rainouts, because, again, this was kind of a record year early for postponements in baseball. It's like, why don't they put a roof on everything? And, of course, I know this plays to you because of what your opinion is. It's like, well, yeah, how many municipalities are going to pay the extra to put a roof on when it's hard enough now to get government money to take care of stadiums?
Well, it's outrageous for governments to be involved in that business. As you know, this is one of my pet issues, and I don't think that it's right anymore, especially with all the problems facing you civically, to spend money on stadiums, and in particular with no guarantee that the product stays, the fact that everyone you talk about losing money, this and that, no one loses money. Everyone makes money when they sell their team, significant amount of money. They say that it operates the public trust, but it doesn't. You know, teams threaten to leave if they don't get what they want all the time. So I agree it's about pride. Look, it, Seattle did it just like L.A. did it. Waited, and now you got an arena coming in, which is completely privately financed. The team obviously is privately purchased, which is still the case in most situations. But you're right, municipalities aren't going to do it, and nor should they do it. The money should be spent on other things rather than pro sports franchises.
No, that I agree with, and of course, it's just going to be tougher. And again, the cost of stadiums keep going up so much that it is very difficult. And what you kind of wonder is that what is going to be the future of getting these stadiums? Because I think you look at most cases, the old models used to be you had a 20-year lifespan on most stadiums. Now you better get 30, but what happens when you get past 30?
Well, I mean, that's the deal in Arizona right now. I mean, their ballpark, which is the one with the swimming pool out in the outfield, 25 years into it, and they're demanding a new one already, and they're trying to railroad a tax increase through. I mean, what will eventually happen is more owners will do what Jerry Jones did. Now, Jerry Jones took some public money, but he also put in about $1 billion of his own money. Those guys, the amount of money in particular in most leagues now, the NHL may not be the same thing, but they didn't have any problem finding investors to come into Seattle who had the money to pay the expansion fee and had the money to buy the team. It's a great investment, and you will see the owners have the money to do it. You know, no one's barely scraping by to buy a pro sports franchise. Everyone who's doing it is buying it as a toy. They have the money to pay for it, and either the future is completely private from now on, or, like I said, we'll see smaller stadiums and a more premium crowd going to games, in the next 20, 30 years.
Yeah, and also you're right about the revenue, because the revenues come so much from television.
Well, television, and then there's a whole new world of revenues opening up. I mean, right now it's TV. Right now it's in particular cable networks because of programming. But everyone, the NFL has always led the charge on this, and everyone else is kind of falling in line. Now you have things streaming, everything like that. I mean, it's not just sports. For example, I was watching the season finale of The Big Bang Theory, which is a real popular show on CBS, and they had their last episode of the year. And within 10 minutes of the episode being on, I'm watching the show on afterwards, and they run an ad for the show again. And I'm like, geez, what a mistake. How could they do this? Well, it wasn't an ad for the show again to watch it on TV. It was to announce that now it's available on all of our streaming platforms. So, I mean, it's just beginning a new era of streaming. How that's going to play out, I don't think anyone has any idea. But there's going to be no short. Again, it's going to be an issue of having content. And sports is always going to be able to provide that. So there are going to be many, many, many new and revenue streams for all sports that we can't even imagine nowadays what that's specifically going to be. But it'll be access to everything and access for everything. And it's coming soon, we think.
Yeah, and of course, what's also coming very soon, in fact, we may be on overtime right now, is a decision by the Supreme Court on gambling.
Yeah, what is going on with that, I wonder? Because unless they're, you know, unless the lobbying's fast and furious, of course, there are other far more important things to deal with. But I've said to you that I think, look, you've already got it legal in several places. It's legal all over the world. It's inevitable. It's inevitable. So I'll be curious to see if, in fact, they do go ahead and approve it. And you know, the leagues are just trying to get their pound of flesh, and they're certainly willing to negotiate with them at this point, I would assume. But the leagues get a little bit of money out of it. I think it sails right through, and I think we'll see it much sooner than later. You're right about that.
Yeah, and I already saw there's like a big battle in West Virginia with the politicians there about how to handle it. Some are going against, and some are going for. I mean, it is a big, ugly battle.
Well, West Virginia, which has no pro sports at all.
Right.
Right. I mean, no football, no pro baseball, no pro basketball. No hockey. Who really cares what West Virginia thinks?
Mm-hmm. No, no question. But
in this particular debate, I mean, because they don't stand to make much money out of it.
What do you think is the right way to handle it if you're going to be the sports entities? I mean, the NBA has come out and said, hey, we want 1% of the gross. We want give
I
us
think
money.
That's the way to do it. I mean, you try and get what you can get, but at the end of the day, if you don't get anything, realize that it's going to help your bottom line. It's going to enhance interest in your sport, whether or not you get a tangible 1% like the NBA is pursuing. Or not, it's going to, like fantasy sports have increased interest, certainly in the NFL, gambling is going to increase interest in all sports. So I agree with the NBA's approach, and I'm sure the NFL, Major League Baseball are doing the same thing. Try and get something, but you're not going to oppose it if you don't.
No.
I mean, there's no reason for it not to happen, because at the end of the day, it enhances your product. It doesn't hurt it.
No, I agree. And how I mean, is it going? Do you anticipate any difference now if there is going to be legalized gambling? What? Because will injury reports now be more important? How many different things going on during the game involving gambling?
Well, you know, John, I mean, there's billions of dollars of illegal gambling going on right now, and you know better than anyone, injury reports are important right now. You know, it's funny. You know, the NFL is diligent about it, and they will fine teams if they fool around with the system. Now, what is the reason for an injury report? To help gamblers. There's mm-hmm. no other reason for it. There's no other reason whatsoever. I mean, in college football, you know, the coaches like Mike Leach and others never reveal injuries, which is what you'd rather do. That'd have a competitive edge. The only reason to reveal injuries is to give gamblers information. So they're already doing it. It's already significant in football, and I think, you know, you may see more of it in baseball, although teams, you know, tend to be fairly straightforward and forthcoming about it, but certainly it'll put more emphasis on that. But it's my point again is that there's already billions of dollars wagered illegally in this country. The injury report is already a huge part of the NFL landscape, so I don't think a whole lot has to change when gambling becomes legal. They're already doing what the gamblers need.
Mm-hmm. No, it's going to be...
honestly, John, is there another reason for the injury report?
No. No, I mean, let's put it this way. Now, it helps on fantasy. Fantasy because it has become big on it.
Fair point. But fantasy football is gambling, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's very few people that are in fantasy football leagues just for laughs.
Right.
Almost every one of them it's a pool, it's for money, so... I mean, it's just another form of illegal gambling. And I'm not talking about the big guys, the DraftKings, the things like that. I'm talking about when you get together with 12 buddies, you all put in $100 and you play a fantasy football league. That's gambling. So, you know, I don't know what else you call it. It's definitely something from the NFL standpoint. You know, they could pursue the 1% option like the NBA, but again, there's just no way they're going to go against it if they don't get it, because it enhances their product.
So what's on the schedule for Graz today?
You know, baseball, I hope. The Western Conference Stanley Cup Finals are starting tonight, which I'm definitely interested in. Las Vegas, the expansion team playing Winnipeg. And I don't know if you've noticed, but Tiger Woods had a hell of a day at the Players' Championship today. Shot a 65. So that's the fifth major, basically, in golf. So it'll be kind of interesting to keep an eye on that tomorrow when it's 80 degrees. And happy Mother's Day, by the way, to everyone.
Hey, very good you said that again. Hey, thank you so much. And, Dave, I'll talk to you on Monday.
You got it, John.
Okay, that's Dave Grosby, Bob Gros and Tom, weekdays 12 to 3 here on 710 ESPN. Hey, let's load up the phone lines at 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle and 710sports.com. Now, more John Clayton.
866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's go to Philip. Philip, how are you?
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you about the Earl Thomas situation. What's the latest on with him?
Not too much. I mean, I know that he's still staying away from the off-season program. He's told through his representatives that he's not going to hold out into the season. And so now the question is he going to miss the mini camp? Is he going to miss training camp? Those haven't been determined, but nothing new. I think he still wants to stay a Seahawk. But at the moment, they just have to kind of play it out and wait and then see what happens at mini camp. As far as trade, the Cowboys didn't offer anything that was even close. I mean, they didn't offer a first, a second, or a third. And so with no true offer there that would make any sense, they just couldn't consider any trade. So right now he's just on hold.
You know, and I have to say I was quite relieved that we weren't going to trade him. I mean, this guy is an all-pro talent, and to only get like a second round, maybe a third round pick top from him, that to me would sound ridiculous. And, you know, we have him on the contract for another year, and, you know, if he doesn't, we don't get him to a long-term deal before the season ends, you know, let's pull the franchise tag out and have him for another year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you know, we can also use the same scenario that the Dolphins did with Jarvis Landry. Do you see that playing out?
Yeah, because I think what it comes down to is first, I think what they have to determine, because I think you can see that some of the guys, at least in the case of Pete Carroll, kind of lost a little faith in the way that this thing was being put together. And so that's why Michael Bennett and Richard Sherman aren't here. Now you want to test and say, okay, is Earl all in or is he not? And then once you determine that, then you kind of judge the long-term future. Until you do that, I don't think you talk contract or anything of that nature, because again, it's going to be so expensive to get something done. But I think the first thing you want to see is he wanting to be with this team in reality? You see how he comes. But of course, that can only happen when you see him with the team.
I see. And last thing to Urso is, you know, I know we brought in Brandon Marshall this past week or so, and Dez Bryant remains unsigned. I mean, do you see us doing a one-year deal with Dez Bryant for, you know, maybe $5-6 million a year?
No, because I don't think they can afford to do that. I mean, that would be too much money. And I think that anything they can do is going to be on the cheap, and that's the case. Because remember, they still have to look to see if they can get something done with Tyler Lockett, Frank Clark. You know, they have to be taken care of, maybe something with Earl Thomas. So I don't think they can afford to put $5, $6 million into it, and that's why I don't think that they can get Dez Bryant.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, John, for taking my call. I really appreciate
okay.
it.
Okay. Thank you, and thanks for being so patient. Hey, boy, I tell you what, the birthday continues because just got a call from John Kingdom, who's in town, who used to work with the Raiders, and he got himself a great book that he's worked with so many different things about the Raiders and Al Davis and all that stuff. He's going to join us next. It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, more John Clayton on 710 ESPN Seattle and 710sports.com.
Well, what a gift. I mean, again, yesterday was such a great birthday. Now it kind of continues today because right during the last segment, we got heard from John Kingdon, who worked with the Raiders for so many years and such a good guy with the league. And he had a book that he's put together that has been now on the market now for a little less than a year, Behind the Shields. And John Kingdon joins us. And John, boy, tell me how the book is going, because that book was sensational. Talking about Al Davis, talking about the Raiders and all that. And that book was just great.
Yeah, we did pretty well with our first printing. We're in a second printing now, and you know, at this part is we've sort of broken even already, and so pretty much now is going to be gravy on top. And, you know, the most satisfying thing has been the feedback from people in the league. Scott Fitterer, of course, with Seattle, called me and told me he loved the book, and Lance Newmark, the personnel director in Detroit, same thing, and a lot of people with the team. And so it's been fun. It came out last September, and you know, it's still selling. I think even for a couple of weeks, we actually beat the Tom Brady book as number one. And Tom's kind of stayed up there a little longer than we have, but still, we had a lot of great feedback and positive response to it.
That's great. What the best part is that you really got into the culture, what it was like, and kind of like the history of the way Al Davis ran things.
Well, you know, the idea, you know, to come up with it, you know, Bruce and I sort of talked about it. And every time, you know, when you're out scouting and you're in a room with a bunch of scouts, maybe there's a break, people would ask, you know, talk about what went on in their draft rooms. And, you know, Bruce and I separately would talk about it. And we always got the same responses. Well, you guys got to write a book. So that always planted the seed. And so we tried to really be as honest and candid about everything, good, bad, and indifferent. You know, and Steve Corcoran, who also was involved in writing it, you know, when I first sat down with him and talked about doing it, he said, "Well, it's, you know, it's got to be warts and all." I said, "Absolutely." We just, you know, and I think we're both good, bad, and indifferent, and I think really put you in the draft room and had a lot of fun with it. You know, but the reason I called you, just real quickly, I'm actually in Tacoma right now. I flew in this morning. I had the radio on, and here's John Clayton show coming on. And my daughter's graduating at the University of Puget Sound tomorrow.
Okay.
So I said, "Well, I got to tell you, that's all." I said, "Well, I got to give John a call."
Well, that's fantastic, because it's great to hear from you, because I miss seeing you, because I haven't seen you in so long. And, you know, naturally, it was so much fun, because, again, the league is always better when the Raiders are good, because it's such a great brand. The fans are so good. It's such a unique experience kind of just covering and watching. And, it was just fun to watch what would happen each year with the Raiders.
Sure. It was never dull in that sense. You know, just... You know, I'm not involved, but watching it from the outside and the people that I know on the draft this year, I'm very positive that coaches had much more input this year than otherwise. You know, Tom Cable, I'm sure had a strong input on those two linemen they drafted from NCANT and UCLA. And then Paul Gunther, I believe, you know, took the nose tackle out of Sam Houston, who's a carbon copy of the guy he relied on in Cincinnati for so long. The only proviso I put out is, you know, Tom was a hard worker and a good coach. He was not a good personnel evaluator. I still remember, you know, we had signed Quame Harris, the free agent, and, you know, nobody was all that excited about it. And Tom came out in our draft meeting and said, you know, if Quame came out in the draft this year, he'd be the top lineman. Well, he lasted 1 year and then he was gone. So, you know, Tom, it was strong and worked hard, but that wasn't his forte. So hopefully he's right for them on those two picks.
Yeah, in fact, that is a little bit of the scary part, because I know I've been talking about it for the last couple of weeks, because when they gave John Gruden the 10-year, $100 million contract, they took away, you know, more power from Reggie McKenzie, who had done a good job of building the team to that 12-win level. And now you can see that, you know, it's all over the place. I mean, they've got 14 players in their 30s on the roster. They're taking gambles on Martavius Bryant. They took gambles in the draft on players that either weren't at the combine or had some off the field issues. I mean, you know, when you have the coaches involved, it can be a little scary.
Yeah, you know, some of them are really good at it, and some of them just aren't that good at it. I mean, the best one to me was Earl Leggett, the offensive, you know, the D-line coach and a great player. He was a great personnel evaluator, and we always relied on him, and others, some of them didn't like doing it, and some of them wanted to do it, were just bad at it. So it's a mishmash. You know, look, you could hear there. I mean, there's no one a more supportive and bigger fan of John Gruden. But there's a lot of things. You got a new coach, you got a new staff, you got a new system, and a whole lot of new players. You know, and the one thing I would, you know, Reggie should be thankful for every day is he ought to send a dozen roses every week to Ray Farmer for taking Johnny Manziel instead of Derek Carr. Because without Derek, it really would have been a real problem.
Oh, no question. What was it like working with Al? Because, you know, naturally he was as unique as you're going to find.
Well, I really like, you know, you first started, it was a challenge. You know, I first started and he'd ask you something and a question that I didn't think of. And, well, I don't know, you know, it was boom. And then you sort of know, you know, every time now I was prepared for that type of question. So, you know, obviously, you know, fell off physically, just couldn't keep up at the end. But but he looked at things from every angle. You know, he was a very intelligent man. He liked the term genius, and that made him look strong. But, you know, when you're really smart, and he was intelligent, and you work 24 hours a day on one subject, you're going to be pretty good on that subject. You know, and I'm not, but he was also, you know, varied. Had varied interests. He kept up in politics, kept up on all the other sports. So again, if he asked you a question and you didn't have the answer, you know, you damn knew well it was going to come back that same question the next time you talked to him. And I was always prepared for that next one coming up. But you know, he lived the life that he wanted to live and he loved doing it. And, you know, right to the end. I mean, it's the day before he died, you know, he said, yeah, I think I'm going to fly in tomorrow to Houston, which I knew he wasn't going to do. But he would not allow himself to concede that he might not be able to do it. And then he passed away that evening.
Hmm. How many late night phone calls did you get from him?
You know what? I was, again, first time it happened, it kind of caught me off guard. I didn't have anything information with me. But it was, I get calls all over the time. I'd be Oregon State practice and, you know, geez, why did we take this guy, you know, last year? And like, but it was a weekly thing. It could be a lot more than such, and then once or twice. But I learned, again, I used to keep, you know, a set of books at home. You know, the spreadsheets really help, but I'd have those at home, and I have, you know, the same thing at the office. So, I'd get a call about, who are the top linebackers this year, how do we rank the quarterbacks? And, you know, so I was able to have it at hand because of the computers. But, you know, one time I was in L.A., just a cute story, and my daughter was graduating this year, and she might have been 3 or 4 years old. And the phone, and again, I wasn't home, but Al called my house, and my wife thought it was me. She told my daughter to pick up the phone, and, you know, she had played some toy basketball. Oh, I played basketball, and blah, 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 you know, just yakking like it was me. And then my wife got the phone. Is this the Kingdon residence? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, Mr. Davis, I'm so sorry. You know, John's going to call. I'll have him call you back. And he says, well, I'm sorry about my daughter. Oh, no, no. I found it very interesting. You know, this is very sweet. I kind of like that. That side a lot of people didn't see.
Oh, yeah, no, I still remember him coming over to my wife at the owner's meeting and because he loved to find out information about everybody. And so he found out my wife was a bowling writer, and he came over and he says, did you know that Sharon Stone was a bowling champion when she was 17? It's like, no, it's like very interesting.
You know, at the end, again, you know, the last couple of years, it was just tough for him to keep up. So when the players would come in from our drafted players, and I'd set them up with cheat sheets. And, you know, this was a high school sport. These were times in track. His brother did this. His dad did this. And so at the end of the day, I said, how to go? Oh, they were so impressed. They seemed, you know, they looked like I came right off the top of my head, which when he was younger, it was off the top of his head. So we adjusted and he adjusted. And, you know, it was sad, you know, at the end, but by the same token, I really had to tip my hat to him because he just would not bow down. He wouldn't, he fought to the last heartbeat. I think basically what happened, his heart just said, look, I've had it. Just can't give it to you anymore. And I think he passed away, fairly peacefully.
I was always enamored by the fact that what his birthday was July 4th, and he would always make it some kind of a special celebration.
Well, in the Vegas stuff, it was like on a 5-year thing and such. But, you know, people would say, well, you don't get any days off except July 4th. And they said, oh, really? Yeah, well, it's Al's birthday. You know, that was the reason we took July 4th off. And, you know, coincidentally enough, that was George Steinbrenner's birthday as well. And I think George was born, Al was born 1929 and George was born in 1930. So it was just kind of a funny coincidence, the two of them. And just a little trivia. I don't know if you remember Irv Kays was a big PR guy.
Yeah,
he's probably the only, he was the PR guy for George Steinbrenner, and he's also the PR guy for Al Davis. So that was that's a pretty good pair to draw to.
that was very good. What is your favorite Al story? What best Al story?
Well, it just that's a tough one. Just kind of a silly story is, you know, I got to be really close with him, and I had a lot of dinners with him, and this wasn't a football story, but I picked him up, and we're going over stuff, and then I was going to drive him back to his place in the Marina City Club, and he says, I'd like to get a burger. Is there a burger place around here? I said, well, there's a place called Fat Burger just down the street. This is in Marina Del Rey down in L.A. Okay, well, let's try it. So I said, sure, I like Fat Burger. It's a wonderful burger place, actually, even with a name like that. So we walked in, and the guy looks at us and says, Mr. Davis, back so soon? What is it, third time this week? And I look at him, and the only time in my life he looks sheepish to me. He's like embarrassed. He says, God, I just love this place. It was, again, a human side to him that a lot of people didn't get to see. I mean, the football stuff, there just was so many. It's kind of hard to kind of jump on one. But, I liked that he liked to take – maybe I think the best part was his he liked so much to try people at different positions, and we had a tremendous amount of success with it. You know, for some reason, tight end, with Todd Christensen, and Derek Ramsey was a quarterback, and the Ethan Horton one was great. And, Sammy Seale was a receiver. He made a DB, and, Willie Brown, actually, when people remember, was originally a tight end coming out of college, and then he went to Denver, and, Al made the great trade to get him there. But I think he loved doing that and found great satisfaction, I think that was maybe the foresight that was really one of the strengths of his ability to evaluate.
That's great. Hey, so now how can everybody get the book Al Davis Behind the Shield?
Well, we got it on Amazon, and then we also have a website, behindtheshield.net. So it's Al Davis, Behind the Raider Shield, and the website is behindtheshield.net. And it's kind of some interviews we've done both on TV and radio. And it's been fun, again, the feedback. Greg Papa, Greg does the mm-hmm. Raiders, and said it was like he's read every book about Al, and this was the best book that was written. He called it a treasure. So that's been really very satisfying.
That's great.
And if you talk to Scotty Fitterer, the personnel director up in Seattle, he loved it too. Great person. I love Scotty.
No, it is a great book. I mean, we usually our second caller, his name is Raider Jim. And so there's a bunch of Raider fans out there. And if you haven't gotten the book, you've got to go get it. So it's on Amazon. And again, it's behindtheshield.net. Is that correct?
That's it. Exactly. It's funny, just real quick. I always, whenever this combine starts, I always think of you because, the only people, it's grown so, but it first started over at the Holiday Inn in Indianapolis. It was basically you, Bob McGinn, and I think the guy out of Dallas.
Rick Goslin.
Really I'm sorry?
Yeah, Rick Goslin.
Rick Goslin.
Yeah.
In the lobby, and that was it.
I remember the first one I covered was 1990, which I guess was the third one in Indianapolis, and there was only seven writers there.
Yeah.
Seven. That was it.
Sure. Yeah, it's crazy how it's just exploded, and it's an amazing. Now it's it's the traveling circus now. I think they're talking about Nashville next year, possibly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you should have saw it in Dallas, and you would imagine it's probably going to end up somewhere in L.A., but I still like it in Indianapolis. Combine is just great. Hey, John Kenyon, it's great catching up with you. Congratulations tonight on your daughter graduating from Puget Sound. That's just fantastic.
Thank you. Yeah, it was just, God, I heard you on the radio. I got to call, John. Thank you so much for letting me talk.
Hey, Don Kingdom, thank you for joining us. And to get that book is Al Davis Behind the Shields. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle and 710sports.com.
866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Great catching up with John Kingdom. Michael Sean Duger will be joining us. We'll talk some Seahawks. He's got a new job we'll talk about. Looking forward to getting to him to talk about that. But give us a call at 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. 23 teams right now have their rookie mini camps going on. And, of course, we were able to get together with Josh Weinfuss, talk about Josh Rosen starting out a little slow, but then coming on and not doing too bad. It's looking like he might have a chance to be a quarterback in the National Football League. And, of course, they made the bold move of trying to go up there and get him. Thought it was interesting that at the moment he kind of thinks it's going to be probably a 6-win team, based on the way he looks at it. And of course, that's understandable because there's so much that they are trying to rebuild in a short period of time. And, they had their run. Bruce Arians did such a great job. And now it's a matter of trying to regroup and reload. And it's a little bit more of a reload than what you see here in Seattle. So, kind of fun to see, but give us a call at 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. The interesting moves going on with the league, and of course, what's going to happen right now coming up here at the owners' meeting. I'm going to try to head to that in Atlanta to kind of get a gauge to see what they're going to do with the kickoff rules and all that stuff. And again, the interesting part about the kickoff rules, it looks like you're going to see a whole different group of special teams, because I know we talked to Brian Snyder about that, special teams coach of the Seahawks. And what you'll see is, probably smaller bodies, faster bodies out there, because what they want to try to do is, have now the kickoffs from the 35-yard line. There you line up, and of course, no running start if that passes. Then, no two-man wedge. That's going to be eliminated. And what you're going to have is three guys that are going to be back. The only three guys on the return team are going to be back that aren't going to be among the eight at the line trying to block the guys coming down. And so you're going to have a little bit more space. Maybe you can get a little bit more on returns. That's going to be one to kind of follow. But, of course, that's going to be coming up here in another week or so. And, of course, we will be there trying to get you all the stuff we can. But in the meantime, Michael Sean Duker will be joining us next. It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.